What does it mean to be too much in a world designed for your absence? Standing in Rudan's, a Charlotte fish joint where Black folks gathered to eat, drink, and maybe dance, a stranger told me, "Your hair thick, your nose thick, your lips thick, all of you just thick." This wasn't a pickup line. It was an observation that captured my lifelong experience of being too much of one thing and never enough of another. Throughout graduate school, editors called my writing too readable for academia, too deep for popular consumption, too country Black for literary circles. A senior Black woman scholar warned me to stop writing so much. They're just using you. I was breaking unspoken rules about who gets to claim intellectual authority. Black women often work endlessly for churches, families, politics, survival, but I was working the wrong way for someone who didn't want to become a problem. Born pigeon-toed and bow-legged, I grew up hearing "fix your feet" alongside "work twice as hard." This physical adaptation became metaphor. I learned to shoehorn political analysis into personal essays, the only genre typically afforded Black women writers. Legacy media profited more from our personal narratives than we ever did. But my work isn't simply memoir. It's thick description, interrogating why my crossword genius grandmother died poor in a one-bedroom apartment while I became a professor. May these essays spark a gold rush for Black women writers so thick with humanity that no sister has to fix her feet to walk this world again. When I casually called myself unattractive while critiquing Miley Cyrus's cultural appropriation, Black women attacked me, some claiming I sought validation, others suggesting self-hatred. From age 11, when my body changed dramatically, I learned beauty's unspoken rule. Nothing was more beautiful than blonde. By high school, I understood beauty isn't about appearance, it's about power. Beauty is the preferences that reproduce the existing social order. While white feminists examine shifting standards from Marilyn Monroe to Twiggy, they miss how beauty fundamentally excludes Blackness. Whiteness remains the constant requirement. My first night at my HBCU, when a pizza delivery man showed interest, I had a revelation. In this Black space, I could be normal, normative, taken for granted as desirable. Beauty is capital, not good capital, but valuable capital. It compounds gender oppression, costs money, colonizes. When I say I'm unattractive, I'm naming what's been done to me and signaling who did it. White women who insist I'm beautiful offer neoliberal self-help because they need beauty to be achievable. If beauty isn't earned but assigned, they become as vulnerable as I am. I never dreamed of romance. I dreamed of competency, the click-clack of purposeful heels and a briefcase. Yet competency remains elusive because it's a neoliberal fantasy promising control in an uncontrollable economy. For Black women, structural incompetence is enforced through racism, sexism, and classism. During my pregnancy, I began bleeding at work. At my good obstetrics office on the wealthy white side of town, I waited bleeding through a chair before being dismissed by a doctor who blamed my weight. Days later, excruciating pain was dismissed as constipation. At the hospital, they discovered tumors larger than my baby. Despite my education and insurance, nothing could override assumptions tied to my Blackness. After my daughter died shortly after birth, a nurse blamed me for not announcing I was in labor. Even Serena Williams had to fight for life-saving treatment after childbirth. Black women in America die in childbirth at 243% higher rates than white women. What I learned sitting in a hallway with a dead baby in my arms: networks of capital work most efficiently when your lowest status characteristic is assumed. Once these gears are in motion, you can never be competent enough to save your own life. The elasticity of whiteness, its ability to expand or contract to maintain dominance, is something Black Southerners understand intimately. We know our whites as survival, anticipating their emotions while critically withholding faith in them. This knowledge was tested at my first Obama house party in 2007 in Myers Park, a wealthy white Charlotte enclave built on racist covenants and redlining. The neighborhood exemplifies opportunity hoarding. White families purchase homes in communities with superior infrastructure, gaining access to well-funded schools they transform into private school experiences. I was the only Black person there for nearly an hour. White hosts confidently collected payments for Obama, speaking of him with reverence. While my mother and other Black people doubted a Black man could win, these white residents were certain. Obama's election created a national identity crisis. The paradox of electing both Obama and Trump reveals whiteness's need to expand to defend its position. Obama was allowed to become president because he reflected white voters' ideal selves back at them, promising to change the world without changing them, to change Blackness without being too Black. His careful refusal to attribute opposition to racism was catnip to millions. Despite intimacy with his white family, my first Black president didn't appear to know his whites. He couldn't imagine America electing Trump because he didn't understand that whiteness defends itself against change, progress, hope, Black dignity, Black lives, reason, truth, facts. At a meeting of Black women professors, one colleague declared, "Black people are over," meaning we've supposedly moved past racial categorization. Yet this worked only because of the kind of Black I'm presumed to be in academic spaces: educated, articulate, different. A senior scholar once warned, "I do not trust you. Too many white people like you," predicting my dark skin would prove problematic. Which Black people do I represent? Those across the African diaspora, political left or right, Caribbean descended versus American descended? At elite universities, I encountered persistent preference for Black ethnics, particularly African or Caribbean students, viewed as better prepared than U.S. Black students. This cherry-picks winners from stratified societies while perpetuating stereotypes. People repeatedly ask me to identify as something other than Black-Black, Cape Verdean, mixed, anything explaining my perceived exceptionalism. My response became deliberate protest. If you think anything good about me, reconcile that with me being regular Black-Black. I refuse to code switch on NPR, The Daily Show, or at the White House. Black is not over. The goal of anti-racist work has never been ending Blackness, but ending whiteness as a system of power. When Black shoppers face discrimination, critics question why they buy status symbols, revealing fundamental misunderstanding of how these items function as survival tools. My family achieved modest rural Black wealth through military benefits and insurance policies accumulated over generations. Education was our greatest resource, particularly for girls who could talk like white folks. I watched my mother perform respectability daily, code switching to help neighbors navigate white bureaucracies. Respectability rewards are uncertain, but we work within constraints designed to limit access. How do you price a welfare clerk's double take that gets you extra information? What's the value of a school principal deferring to your child because your presentation signals middle-class advocacy? Poor people buy status symbols for the same reason others do: to belong and survive where appearance determines opportunity. Gatekeepers told me I was acceptable because my car was clean or my suit was Jones, New York, signals I wasn't a typical Black woman. These judgments meant better jobs and higher salaries, creating compounding effects that justified initial investments. When my VP rejected a qualified hairstylist seeking mobility because she wore cotton instead of silk under her blouse, the lesson was clear. Status symbols become keys to unlock gates. Only when born poor and treated as inherently poor will you understand their value. They're investments in future opportunities, not frivolous purchases. In a world demanding Black women shrink ourselves, thickness becomes revolution. Not just physical, but intellectual and emotional. It's refusing to be digestible to systems profiting from our erasure. The work isn't about fixing our feed or smoothing our edges, it's about dismantling structures that demand we do so. Every time a Black woman speaks without code switching, demands competent healthcare, or refuses to be anything other than regular Black-Black, she chips away at whiteness's foundation. This isn't individual empowerment, it's collective liberation. It's creating space for Black women to have one damn job instead of five or six, to write about gardening without explaining systemic racism, to exist without constantly proving our humanity. The question isn't whether we can be thick enough to survive. We've always been that. The question is whether we'll demand a world where our thickness is celebrated rather than punished, where our daughters can be girls before they're forced into womanhood, where competence actually protects us. May we be so thick with humanity that the world must finally bend to accommodate us. That's the work. That's the revolution.